Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Great to be here.
Today we're looking into, well, a really complex and often difficult relationship, the one between Kurds and Turks. We'll be focusing mainly on the history within the region, sometimes called Northern Kurdistan or Turkish Kurdistan.
Right. And we're going to try and trace the historical threads using the source materials provided to see how this dynamic evolved, specifically leading up to the end of 2009.
Exactly. The aim is to walk you through the key moments, the underlying tensions, the interactions, the conflicts, just to give you a clearer picture based on these sources, hopefully without it feeling too overwhelming.
Yeah, because understanding this isn't just about, you know, dates and events. It's about seeing those foundational issues, those moments of cooperation that existed too, and how conflict has really shaped things over time.
Geographically, just to set the scene, we're mostly talking about southeastern Turkey. It's a mountainous area, home to Kurds for, well, millennia, part of that wider traditional Kurdish homeland, stretching across a few modern countries.
And we should probably mention, the term Turkish Kurdistan itself is sensitive. It's used, yes, but also contested, especially within Turkey.
Good point. So we'll stick to the geography described in the sources, but keep that sensitivity in mind. Our historical path today starts way back, with the Seljuks and Ottomans times when there was actually coexistence, even significant Kurdish autonomy.
Then we'll track that big shift under the Turkish Republic, the move towards denial, assimilation, and conflict.
We'll look at how Kurdish identity reemerged politically and culturally, and then the really tough period of armed conflict involving the PKK, taking us right up to 2009.
And the sources really show it's not a simple story, is it? It's full of these cycles, cooperation, giving way to conflict, often driven by, you know, states wanting more central control versus rising nationalisms.
Okay, let's get into those historical roots then. Seljuk and Ottoman times. When the Seljuk Turks arrived in Anatolia, 11th century or so, they encountered established Kurdish populations.
Right. And interestingly, the sources suggest the initial interactions weren't just hostile. They were often strategic. The Seljuks needed allies, and the Kurdish areas were a crucial buffer zone.
So pragmatic alliances were formed.
Exactly. And Kurdish forces were apparently quite important at the Battle of Manzikert in 1071. You know, the famous battle that really opened Anatolia to Turkic settlement. Kurdish involvement there was significant, according to these sources.
What really jumped out at me from the material was the Seljuks actually naming a province Kurdistan.
Yeah, that's quite something. Around 1150, Sultan Sanjar apparently consolidated several Kurdish principalities under that official name. It set a kind of precedent, even if they were still under Seljuk rule.
Okay, moving forward to the Ottomans. Their big rivalry was with the Safavids in Persia, right? And that shaped their relationship with the Kurds.
Absolutely. The Ottomans were Sunni, the Safavids were Shia, and most Kurdish leaders were Sunni. So there was a natural alignment there against the Safavids.
And there was a key figure, Idris Bitlisi.
Yes, a Kurdish scholar and statesman. The sources highlight him as crucial in brokering alliances between Kurdish emirs and the Ottoman Sultan Selim for birth in the early 16th century.
This led up to the Battle of Chaldiran in 1514.
Precisely. Kurdish support was vital for the Ottoman victory, which gave them control of eastern Anatolia. And the payoff for the Kurdish Emirates was, well, remarkable semi-autonomy, hereditary rule, considerable self-governance.
This lasted for centuries.
Yeah, from 1514 right up until the mid-19th century, according to the sources. They mentioned places like Botan, Hakkari, even a vilayet I Kurdistan in early tax records.
So a long period of recognized local power, though not total independence. You mentioned the Treaty of Zuhab split some areas.
Right. In 1639, that treaty with the Safavids did divide some historical Kurdish territories, so autonomy wasn't absolute and borders were contested.
How did the Ottomans actually manage these areas? Was it uniform?
No, not at all. The sources describe a really pragmatic, layered system. You had highly autonomous hukumets, almost like states within the state. Then hereditary districts called sankaks, specifically for Kurdish leaders, the Ekrad Bilisi, who owed duties to Istanbul. And then areas under direct Ottoman rule.
And where did Kurds fit into the bigger Ottoman social structure, like the millet system for non-Muslims?
That's interesting. They were a non-Muslim millet. Their status was unique. Because they were mostly Muslim, they weren't defined by religion like Christians or Jews were in the millet system.
So what was their status based on?
The sources suggest it was really about geopolitics, needing them on the border with Persia and just acknowledging the existing power of these tribal confederations. Practicality, basically. Their autonomy and use of customary law came from that strategic importance.
So a different kind of special status.
Yeah.
What was Kurdish society like then?
mostly tribal, pastoral, led by powerful sheikhs and agas. The relationship with Istanbul wasn't simple loyalty or constant rebellion. It was more like a strategic negotiation. Sources mention leaders sometimes playing Ottomans and Safavids off against each other, depending on their interests.
Okay, so this long period of relative autonomy, it starts to unravel in the 19th century.
Yes, that's the big turning point. Sultan Mahmud II and then the Tanzimat reforms this big push for modernization and centralization across the whole empire. Istanbul wanted more direct control everywhere.
And that directly threatened Kurdish autonomy.
Exactly. It aimed to erode that traditional system. And naturally, it led to resistance. The sources point to major rebellions, like Bedir Khan Beg's in 1847, as a direct reaction against losing that autonomy.
How did the state respond to that resistance?
Forcefully. Centralization efforts intensified. The sources mention things like establishing a centrally controlled Kurdistan Eyalet for a time, but also punitive measures, banishment, discipline, deportation were terms used.
What about Sultan Abdulhamid II later on? Yeah. His approach was different.
A bit. He used pan-Islamism, trying to bind Muslim groups, including Kurds, closer to the throne. The Hamidi cavalry, integrating tribal militias into a state structure, was part of this. It did integrate some tribes, but the sources say it also stirred up trouble between different communities.
And then the Young Turk Revolution in 1908. That seems like another huge shift.
A massive ideological shift. The rise of Turkish nationalism really challenged the old multi-ethnic empire concept, and it specifically challenged Kurdish identity.
How so? What were the policies?
Much more focused on creating a single Turkish nation. Sources talk about aggressive centralization, closing non-Turkish schools, trying to break up tribal structures, forced settlement, even plans to separate chiefs from their tribes during deportations. It was quite systematic.
And this provoked a Kurdish response.
Yes. The beginnings of organized Kurdish nationalism started then, though small at first, according to the sources. The Young Turk era really laid the groundwork for what came next with the Republic.
Right. Which brings us to the Turkish Republic, founded in 1923, a period of really dramatic change for Kurds.
Absolutely dramatic and often very painful. You know, right after World War I, there is actually this flicker of hope. The Treaty of Sevres in 1920 talked about an autonomous Kurdistan.
And even the early Kemalists, during the Independence War, made some promises about autonomy to get Kurdish support.
They did, according to the sources. But that hope vanished with the Treaty of Lausanne in 1923. That treaty defined Turkey's borders, divided the Kurdish homeland, and made zero mention of Kurds or their rights.
The sources call it a great betrayal.
Yeah, that's the feeling described. Once the republic was established, the core Kemalist goal was clear: a unified, homogeneous Turkish nation-state. And within that vision, all Muslim citizens were simply defined as Turks. Ethnic distinctions among Muslims were officially denied.
That's where the Mountain Turk idea comes in.
Exactly. This rather bizarre theory that Kurds were just mountain-dwelling Turks who'd forgotten their language. It served as a justification for denying a distinct Kurdish identity.
So the state basically framed the whole Kurdish question not as a rights issue, but as separatism or just backwardness.
Precisely. And this ideology drove some very aggressive assimilation policies.
Like changing place names.
Yes, changing Kurdish place names to Turkish ones. Banning the public use of Kurdish, the famous Citizens Speak Turkish campaigns.
And the 1934 resettlement law, what was that about?
That was a key legal tool designed explicitly for demographic engineering. The idea was to disperse Kurdish populations, move Turkish populations in, and break up ethnic homogeneity in the region.
So forced relocations were part of this.
Definitely. And the education system was crucial, too. Sources talk about Kurdish children being sent away to boarding schools outside their region specifically to be Turkified. The Elazığ Girls Institute is mentioned as an example, aimed at making Kurdish girls into Turkish women.
The suppression of language and culture sounds incredibly thorough.
It was. Bans on Kurdish organizations, publishing even names and traditional clothing. By 1930, publishing in any language besides Turkish was forbidden.
Wow, that must have devastated oral traditions, too.
Hugely impactful, and made any kind of literary production inside Turkey almost impossible.
Unsurprisingly, this led to resistance. Major uprisings.
Yes, the sources detail several key ones as reactions. Sheikh Said's rebellion in 1925, a mix of nationalist and religious motives. The Ararat Rebellion from 1927 to 30, which ended tragically with the Zilan Massacre, where thousands of civilians were reportedly killed.
And the Dersim Rebellion.
Dersim in 1937-38. The state response there was exceptionally brutal. Massive military force, aerial bombing sources mentioned Sabiha Gökçen's involvement, mass killings, mass deportations.
The state's reaction seems consistently overwhelming.
Yes, disproportionate force was the pattern. Sources give estimates of huge numbers deported or killed between 1925 and 1939. This period left incredibly deep scars, a legacy of trauma and mistrust.
What about their legal status? Lausanne only protected non-Muslims.
Correct. Kurds, being mostly Muslim, had no specific minority rights under Lausanne, so the legal framework effectively criminalized simply expressing Kurdish identity.
There were even laws allowing land expropriation.
Yes, targeting Kurdish landowners. And special administrative zones, the general inspectorates, ruled the region under martial law for decades, from 1927 to 1952. It was even a forbidden zone for foreigners.
So the official line might have been first-class citizens, but the reality described in the sources is, well, very different. Inequality, marginalization, intense repression.
That's the picture painted by the sources for the early republic, yes.
Okay, let's move into the 1950s and 60s. Things seem to shift a bit then. State policies maybe fluctuate, and we see a new kind of Kurdish consciousness starting to emerge.
Yeah, it's a period of some change, but still under tight control. The Menderes government, 1950-1960, brought multi-party politics, and there was some easing, abolishing some police posts, closing those general inspectorates.
What was the strategy there?
The sources suggest it was partly about co-opting traditional Kurdish elites, the Agas, sheikhs bringing them into the political system to get votes and maintain influence.
But there were still limits on independent Kurdish activity, like the 49ers incident.
Absolutely. That incident in 58-59, where Kurdish intellectuals were arrested, showed that any distinct Kurdish organizing was still seen as suspect, as potentially separatist.
Then the 1960 coup, what was its impact?
Kind of contradictory. More repression in some ways, detentions, deportations, assimilation efforts revived. There's even mention in the sources of a state planning organization report in 61 suggesting mixing populations to counter separatism.
But the new constitution 61 also offered more civil liberties.
In theory, yes. And that wider space, ironically, did create some room, however small, for Kurdish expression to grow. Though, again, the region stayed off limits to foreigners until 65.
Then came the 1971 military intervention, the memorandum. Another crackdown.
Yes, a major crackdown on both the left and emerging Kurdish movements. Media bans, mass arrests, organizations like the Workers' Party of Turkey, TP, and the DDKO were shut down.
Did that suppression work?
Well, it drove activists underground, but the sources suggest it also hardened resolve, maybe even radicalized some, and helped build stronger hidden networks.
So despite all this, this era was also important for a Kurdish reawakening.
Definitely. A new generation was emerging, often more educated due to expanded schooling, migrating to cities. We see early cultural clubs, student demonstrations in Kurdish cities in 67.
And the DDKO, the Revolutionary Eastern Cultural Hearths, you mentioned they were shut down, but they were significant before that.
Hugely significant, formed by students in 69. The sources say they openly discussed the Kurdish question, which was radical, and they staged plays in Kurdish. A really bold move against the language bans.
How did they frame their arguments?
Initially, often in leftist terms, focusing on economic underdevelopment, social oppression. The sources suggest this was maybe partly strategic to stay legal, but it also reflected a genuine merging of Kurdish identity politics with leftist ideas about state inequality.
And the Workers' Party of Turkey, TPRP, it provided a legal platform for a while.
It did. At first, the Kurdish issue was framed mainly economically within TP, but Kurdish members pushed hard, and in 1970, TP did something unprecedented for a Turkish party. It passed a resolution recognizing the existence of the Kurdish people and condemning national oppression.
That must have been huge.
It was. TP's rallies mobilized a lot of people,
yeah.
But there were tensions. Sources mentioned splits because some Kurds felt the Turkish left wasn't fully committed to national rights. And then TP got banned in 71 anyway.
What about cultural preservation during this time? Was anything possible?
It was tough, but efforts continued. Sources mentioned journals discussing Eastern problems, a code for Kurdish issues. Yeah. Classic Kurdish texts like Mem Uzin were published, which was important. DDKO held cultural events.
And the diaspora became important.
Increasingly so, especially for publishing in Kurdish, like in Sweden. Later groups like the Mesopotamia Cultural Center built on these earlier efforts to preserve things like Dengbeje story singing and Govan dances. Expressing Kurdish culture itself was a form of resistance.
This period seems to set the stage for what came next. The era of armed conflict.
It does. Which brings us to the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, and the period from the late 70s to 2009.
The PKK was formally set up in 1978, led by Abdullah Öcalan. What was its initial ideology?
The sources describe it as a mix, Marxist-Leninist, revolutionary socialist, and intensely Kurdish nationalist.
Their view was anti-colonial, aiming for an independent state.
Yes, initially. They saw it as a struggle against colonial oppression, aiming for a unified, independent, socialist Kurdistan across the whole region, Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Syria, a direct response, they'd argue, to decades of denial and suppression.
What were their early actions?
Propaganda, recruitment, but also violent clashes with rival Kurdish groups and figures they saw as state collaborators. Then the 1980 coup in Turkey intensified repression and forced Öcalan and others into Syria and Lebanon for training.
And the decision for armed struggle came soon after.
In 1982, yes. Though it's worth noting, as the sources point out, their stated goals shifted over time, especially after the 90s, moving towards demanding rights and autonomy within Turkey. And after Öcalan's capture in 99, he developed his idea of democratic confederalism.
The actual insurgency kicks off in 1984.
August 84, with attacks in Eru and Şemdinli. They used guerrilla tactics, hitting state targets, military police.
But they also targeted others.
Yes, those they labeled collaborators, village guards, state workers, rival Kurds. Sources also mention attacks on schools.
And the state's response. Massive counterinsurgency.
Huge, massive military deployment. And the village guard system, starting in 85, arming local Kurds to fight the PKK. Highly controversial.
And the state of emergency, OCAL.
Declared in 87, lasted till 2002, gave security forces sweeping powers in Southeast, plus brutal tactics like scorched earth in the 90s, destroying thousands of villages to cut off PKK support, and frequent cross-border raids into Iraq and Syria.
Let's talk more about that village guard system, the Korukuluk.
Yeah.
The sources seem to really emphasize its impact.
They do. Set up in 85, aiming to use local militias to help the army, it grew massively, maybe 60,000 guards at its peak.
How was it used?
Sources say it was partly used to reward loyal tribes. But participation was often forced refuse, and your village might be targeted by the state itself.
And the consequences.
Really damaging. It literally pitted Kurd against Kurd. The PKK targeted guards and their families mercilessly. And critically, the sources including human rights groups and even Turkish parliamentary reports document widespread abuses by the guards. Killings, torture, extortion, operating with impunity.
So it empowered certain groups tied to the state.
Yes, and often disrupted existing social structures within Kurdish communities. It was a very divisive and often violent system.
Okay, wow. That's a lot to take in.
Yeah.
The sheer scale of that. Before we move to the final years before 2009, oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Bosh Hannah.
Ah, perfect timing. Let's see what we have today.
Okay. Yeah, this is good. Got a nice warmth to it. Not too bitter, you know. Sugar's about right. Definitely wakes you up.
Yeah, I agree. It's hitting the spot. Good balance. Needed this.
All right, then. Tea break officially over. Let's get back to it. We were just talking about the conflict dynamics, the village guards. The sources make it starkly clear. The human cost of this whole era was just immense.
Devastating is the word. Human rights groups documented systematic abuses by state forces under Öcalan.
Forced displacement, village burning. The scale sounds enormous.
It was. Over 3,000 settlements destroyed. Official displaced numbers are huge, hundreds of thousands. But some estimates in the sources run into the millions. People having their homes, crops burned, just forced out.
And torture.
Systematic and widespread in custody, according to the reports. Beatings, electric shock, falaka, sexual assault, mock executions. Hundreds reportedly died in detention, plus extrajudicial killings and enforced disappearances, especially in the 90s. Activists, journalists, civilians vanishing. Thousands of cases documented. Mass graves found later.
The European Court of Human Rights found Turkey responsible in many cases.
Thousands of cases, yes. It underscores the scale of state violations documented.
But it's crucial to state, the sources also detail serious abuses by the PKK.
Absolutely essential to include. They targeted collaborators, guards, state employees, rival Kurds, often with summary executions and massacres.
The Pinarkik massacre is mentioned.
Yes, 1987. Over 30 killed, mostly women and children. They also attacked schools, teachers. Sources mention urban bombings, suicide attacks causing civilian deaths.
There were also accusations of forced recruitment.
Yes, including minors, and reports of torture or killing of internal dissenters. Allegations of drug trafficking involvement are also noted in the material.
Beyond the direct violence, the socioeconomic impact must have been terrible.
catastrophic for the Southeast, which was already poor, huge cost to the state, diverting resources. People lost homes, land, livelihoods from village destruction.
Leading to mass migration.
Yes, hundreds of thousands ended up in slums in big cities across Turkey, Diyarbakir, Istanbul, Izmir facing hardship and discrimination. Agriculture was shattered. Big projects like GAP were undermined by the conflict. And constant insecurity just fueled more unrest.
What was daily life like for civilians caught in the middle?
The sources paint a picture of life under OHAL. Constant fear, curfews, checkpoints, surveillance. Simple things like healthcare were affected by language barriers due to state policy. Memoirs, like Sakin Kanzi's, describe horrific prison conditions, especially in Diyarbakir, which became a symbol of repression and radicalized many.
The trauma sounds immense.
Deep, lasting trauma. Displacement fractured families, communities, culture. The sources really convey the deep scars left on society.
Okay, so bringing us toward the very end of our period up to 2009, what are the key things happening then?
Well, Öcalan's capture in 99 was obviously huge. It led to PKK ceasefires, though they didn't always hold.
And the EU process in the early 2000s had some effect.
It prompted limited reforms on Kurdish language, allowing private courses, some broadcasting. Small steps, but noted in the sources as significant shifts, however hesitant.
But the banning of pro-Kurdish parties continued.
Yes, that pattern persisted. HADP banned in 2003. Then the DTP, the main party at the time, shut down by the court right at the end of our period in 2009. It shows the ongoing difficulty for legal Kurdish politics.
And the conflict itself.
The PKK ended its ceasefire, and the insurgency kicked up again in 2004 after a lull.
And 2009 also saw the government announce an opening.
Right. The AKP government launched the Kurdish Opening, or Democratic Initiative, supposedly aiming for a political solution. But crucially, as the sources highlight, this happened almost simultaneously with the banning of the DTP, a real contradiction, showing the state's conflicting signals offering dialogue while closing down the main channel for legal Kurdish political voice.
So we've covered a huge amount of ground based on these sources, from those early Ottoman alliances and autonomy.
Through the Republic's denial, suppression, the violence.
The reemergence of Kurdish identity,
yeah.
The long, devastating conflict, PKK actions, state repression, ending in 2009 with this mix of tentative openings and continued restrictions.
It's incredibly complex. You see that constant tension. State centralization versus Kurdish aspirations. You see identity shifting from tribal or religious towards modern nationalism. And the sheer human costs, the cycles of violence and deep mistrust embedded by 2009.
Understanding this history, even just up to 2009, as outlined in these sources, feels vital for making any sense of the ongoing situation, the deep roots of the issues.
Absolutely. It frames so much of what came after.
So reflecting on everything we've discussed, from the sources, the contested identity, the decades of state denial and violence, the documented abuses by both state forces and the PKK, the displacement, the trauma, here's something to think about. What enduring challenges does this specific history up to 2009 pose for any genuine attempt at reconciliation, justice, or lasting peace in the years that followed? How might the unresolved issues and deep grievances documented here continue to shape that relationship today?
A heavy question, but one that emerges directly from the history we've explored.
Indeed. Well, that's all we have time for in this examination. Thank you for joining us on the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.